History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are stories there that should not go untold. And of course, they really don't have to go untold as long as we don't wait too long to do something about it. Take the initiative, ask a few questions. Most importantly, listen as patiently as you need to for stories from long ago to return to the surface and take on new meaning in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. You can hear the voices of three different World War II veterans today, and I think it's all going to make sense for you. Some of you may have Valentine's on your mind, but there's something else that comes to mind this week for Americans of Japanese ancestry. In communities throughout our country this weekend and next weekend, Day of Remembrance observances are being held because it was on February 19, 1942, that President Franklin D. Roosevelt issued Executive Order 9066, ultimately leading to the incarceration of more than 120,000 people, many of them American citizens. I encourage you to look up Day of Remembrance ceremonies in your area, and if you're ever in the Los Angeles area, the Go for Broke National Education Center has a really powerful exhibit on that period and the Japanese internment. But we're going to get perspective on it today through the memories of Robert Uesaka, one of our last connections to the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. Born in Southern California but raised in Arizona's Salt River Valley, Bob was the youngest of four children in a farming family.
Back in the 30s, Depression era was pretty tough. People were always in need. And growing up in that era, you know, your philosophy on life is much different than those of the young people today. Save what you could and utilize what you have. That was the mode of living in that era.
Well, and I'm wondering if maybe you have some examples of that maybe young people today would say, really? Did they really do that? Do you look back on some things that you did that didn't seem like a big deal then but might be now?
Well, being in that era, as children, we had much more freedom than the children of today. We didn't have the fears that most of the parents have for their children today. We had more peace and nobody bothered us as we roamed the countryside. We always lived in the country. And we're always a farming family, so basically we didn't suffer as much as far as food and the bare necessities as some of the people in the cities. Most of our basic needs were always there, so we didn't suffer as much as some of the other families might have.
What all did you grow on your farm?
With strawberries, cantaloupe, and, produce and berries, most of the stuff that truck farming in those days.
But since you were the youngest, they didn't make you do anything around the farm, right?
No, I was the youngest. You know, in the 30s, I was only preteen, so there's not much I could do. But I remember how hard it was for not only our family, but for everybody. Like, farm labor was 10 cents an hour. And, they worked 7 days a week, 10 hours a day. They'd take $7 home. And still, they made a bare living with that. So things were difficult. But as a child, you don't realize how difficult it is for the parents.
Well, and if you can remember that child, that young boy, I'm sure you're influenced somewhat by your two older brothers and your older sister. But do you remember having ambitions, dreams, ideas of, hey, someday here's what I'm going to do?
Oh, yeah. I always wanted to become a doctor. And I was taking some of the courses and things. But then when Pearl Harbor happened and we were taking it to camps and everything, well, all that went out the window.
Well, I'd like to understand your life before that happened. Like you said, you're a teenager.
16.
16 when Pearl Harbor happens. Going to school, had you ever experienced any kind of discrimination, or were you ever made to feel that you were different because your parents had immigrated from Japan?
Oh, yeah, constantly. You know, friends that you had prior to Pearl Harbor no longer were your friends. Everybody looked at you with a jaundiced eye. Even at home when your telephone rang, somebody always picked up. It was party line. somebody picked up to listen in on the conversation every time. And by law, we were restricted to not go too far from where you lived. But at the time, I was 16. So that was about the way life was at that point. But there was a lot of prejudice toward the Japanese in Arizona, Salt River Valley at that time. And there was a lot of problems.
What about before Pearl Harbor? Had you dealt with that much before, or did that really catch you off guard when that happened?
No, all this prejudice would happen before Pearl Harbor. Some of the Japanese homes where people would throw homemade bombs against the house. I had a good friend that his house was bombed. They would open the gates to the irrigation water and flood your fields and stuff like that would happen. And if you had some vehicle parked near the ditch, they would push it into the ditch. Things like that. And we've one instance, there were five of us young, because I was a second grader at the time. They chased us. You know, they were high school kids. They chased us, and we were away from home. But we had BB guns, so we were able to get rid of them.
Well, we can laugh about it now, but I'm sure at the time, things like that were really upsetting to you. What maybe gave you stability or a sense of connection or someone to depend on when it seemed like so many people were against you?
Well, you know, not everybody. You had instances where people were, I guess, more tolerant toward us and all that. All through pre-Pearl Harbor and post-Pearl Harbor days, there were the missionaries that came from the different denominations. They were very friendly and very helpful. They brought stability in our lives. Like even after I left camp, we were in Colorado, and it was the missionaries there that really opened their doors for the evacuees and all that. So life became more normal.
What about December 7th, 1941? Do you remember how you found out what happened?
Oh, yeah. We didn't find out till later that evening because everybody was working on a Sunday to get ready for the sending the produce to the market on Monday morning. So it wasn't until that evening we heard about it. At first, it was, you know, you wouldn't believe it, but then after you saw the headlines the following morning in the newspaper, it became a reality. I guess it affected each individual in a different way. Like, I was younger, so it wasn't that traumatic as it might have been for my parents. And for them, the war ended their time of being self-sufficient and everything. They were semi-invalid even before the war. But then after Pearl Harbor, their productivity was just cut off, and they never became productive after that.
Did you have to go to school the next day?
Oh, yes. We went to school until evacuation, where they had took us into camp.
Well, what was it like at school the next day, and how many Japanese-American students do you think there were in your school?
Oh, there might have been about less than a dozen. So there were instances where prejudice showed up. Like, we had one fellow that was a senior in high school. He was chosen to be king of the one of the ceremonies at the end of the school year. Well, the superintendent took that honor away from him. Of course, he didn't have to evacuate because he was on the other side of the line.
Well, explain that to me. So where you lived, there was a line of demarcation for who had to go in the camps and who could live quasi-free.
Yes, there's a main highway bisecting Salt River Valley there. Everybody who lived on the south side of that highway would evacuate first, and then those who lived on the north side would follow eventually. But then it turned out that for some reason or other, the government chose not to take them into camp. So they got to stay there while we were in camp, and they never did have to go to camp. We heard rumors that they were running out of produce, and they were mostly produce farmers, so they needed them to grow the crops.
Well, I guess I should ask you this too, because now we look in hindsight, and you know, this is something you've lived with, and we know that this happened, that Japanese Americans on the West Coast were forced out of their homes, that in many cases they lost everything they had, and we'll hear about your family's story. But at the time, even after Pearl Harbor, even with the discrimination you dealt with, could you ever have imagined that the government would lock you all up behind barbed wire?
Well, that never occurred to us that it would ever happen. You know, the Bill of Rights and everything gives you that freedom. But then, unfortunately, it can be taken away. That's what happened to us. But, you know, being 16, it doesn't hit you as hard and negatively as it would otherwise. If I were older, it would have been more serious. But then, you know, 16, you're still a kid yet, and these things really don't have a large impact on your life.
And so we have a sense of the scope of this. Before Pearl Harbor, before 9066, 3 months later, your family had this farm. How many acres do you think you were farming?
80 acres. You know, my parents could never own property. They were prohibited by law and could not become citizens or own property. Even to rent the property, they had to get a third party to sign the lease. So, it was always a problem. But my dad would have liked to own property, but by law he couldn't.
Just because he was an immigrant from Japan?
Oriental.
That's what they called him then.
Yeah, from the Orient.
But he'd overcome some of those obstacles. You're leasing this land, you're farming 80 acres. As you said, that got you through the Depression with the food right there. And he was the family, you were supporting a family of six on this land. And all of that was taken away from you.
There were crops that could be harvested at that time, but then there was nobody to come forth and to buy it. So you just have to abandon it. And that's what we did. It was forced on, so you couldn't do anything about it.
And this was an incredible hardship for every Japanese-American family who got sent to a camp. In your family's case, they actually split your family apart. What happened there?
Well, my oldest brother, to conduct business, he went to the north side of the line, who had more freedom at that time. So he conducted the business for the produce being sold and all that. So he left. My dad was an enemy alien, so he was taken into a different camp by the FBI. They just came one day and told him he had to go to, and they picked him up and just took him. So that just left the three of us at home until the time we were evacuated and put into the camps.
How did you handle that as a 16-year-old, to see your father taken away from your family just like that?
Well, there's not much you can do. You wish it didn't happen, but it did, and you just have to live with it. It was hard for the older, especially for my oldest brother and sister and my mother, but they carried on the work of the farm, and we had strawberries at the time and some other things, and they would continue harvesting until we left.
When your father was taken away by the FBI, how long prior to your going to the camp was that?
Well, 2 months. I think my dad was taken in March, if I remember correctly, and we were sent to the camps in May.
And I'm sure you had no idea what to expect, but what did you find when you got to that internment camp in Poston, Arizona?
We initially, the Arizona people, there were roughly 250 of us that were taken into the camps initially. We were sent to a CCC camp in northern Arizona, a little town called Mayer. They had a little camp there, which they enclosed and made rooms there for the families to occupy. The kitchen was there and everything, so we stayed there for a couple months, and then we were sent to Poston.
What did it feel like to be a teenager and to be locked up in this camp with these other people that, you've got a few family members, maybe you know some of the other folks? What was your day-to-day life like, and what was your outlook at that point?
Well, it's an experience that, like most of the people that went to camp, we knew, because the Japanese people in Arizona, there were times when we had to band together, so we knew a lot of them. As far as for myself, it wasn't difficult at all, because, you got other young people that are there. We had football games and different kind of things that you did. For me, it was more like an adventure.
You were the right age for that, I guess, huh?
Sure, you're more carefree, and you don't have the responsibilities of worrying about the family and all that. So, sure, you thought about your father and all that who weren't there, because only four of us went to camp. My oldest brother was in Colorado, and my dad was in the different camp, so it was a little bit difficult for that in that respect.
Were you guys able to correspond with your father at all?
Oh, yeah, you could write letters, but then everything was censored. You'd get letters with blocked out things and all that. A portion of the letter would be blocked out if they didn't want us to know where he was and all that kind of stuff. Well, it was all blocked out. And I suppose they did the same to the letters we sent to him.
Which camp was he in?
Well, there's several of them. He was in Lordsburg. He was in Crystal City. There were several of them they was shifted around to.
Did you ever understand why?
No. No, you don't know what the government does with when they take people in. So you just have to be patient and wait till you get a letter from them to let you know that he's okay.
So when they moved you from that first camp in northern Arizona down to Poston, then you're in a much bigger camp with a whole lot of Japanese Americans who they had forced out of California, right?
Oh, yeah. I never knew there were so many Japanese. We had people from all over California in the western states. In Poston, you got to know different people. there were a lot of problems too. But then for us younger, you know, the young guys, we had our sport programs. We had baseball teams, softball teams, and all that. So it was a lot of fun.
I've seen some photographs, and I've read a lot about baseball, particularly in that camp and neighboring camps. It probably didn't look like the baseball fields that we see in that part of the country right now, though. What can you describe for us the setting or the fields you played on and how much of a big deal that was to have the chance to play baseball there, or how big of a distraction or outlet that was?
Oh, yeah. Well, that was one of the big outlets. You know, one of the things that without the sports and everything, you know, life in camp would have been real dull. Of course, you had your dances and church services and all that, but then sports was one of the big draws for the young guys. As far as the facilities, we had to create our own. They had empty areas in the camps, so you cleared the area and formed your own lines and created your own baseball field. And, you know, miraculously, the ball and the bats would come from someplace. Some people from outside the camp would donate it and send it in. And we have friends from Arizona that came in and visited us, and they would bring us some sports equipment, horseshoes and things like that, that they thought we might enjoy. So things like that was a bright part of what we experienced.
What position did you play?
Second base. I was a young kid, but, you know, most of the guys were older. There were a few of us younger guys on the team, but it was a lot of fun.
Looking back now, what do you think was the hardest part, the most challenging aspect of life behind that barbed wire?
For my mother. You know, she had very severe rheumatoid arthritis. It was hard for her to walk and all that. And everything, where you went, you had to walk. And it was very difficult for her. So that was one of the things that really was really hard to see. And, you know, this is going back, but when my dad was taken into the different camp, he had bad asthma. And when he was taken to the camp, and he was put into tents and everything and a lot of dust, with his weakened lung, he became sick. They didn't have the facilities to treat him in those camps, so they sent him back to our camp. We had the hospital and the facilities, so they sent him back there. But there was no transportation to go from our barrack to the hospital or things, so my mother couldn't go. So I was the only one that could go. My sister and my other brother had already gone from camp, so I would go up there, but I was underage, so I couldn't even go to the ward to see him. I had to stay outside the window from his window and talk to him through an open window. He became well, but since he came from a different camp, they wouldn't release him. And they told him that the only way they would release him to leave the hospital was to leave camp and ask me to make arrangements so that I could have my mother and father and I would leave camp and join our brother and two brothers in Colorado. Well, you know, being 17 at that time, they don't pay much attention to you. And I had a difficult time in trying to talk to the administration about leaving camp. Finally, I got it through, and then there was no, you know, we didn't have any money or anything, so they didn't have anything set up for people to leave camp at that time. So I had to ask my sister, who had gone to Des Moines to work, asked her to send us some money for a railroad fare to go to Denver, and she did. So finally got the paperwork done, and I took my mother and father out and took them to join our two brothers in Colorado. And that was in 1943, and we were one of the first families to leave camp. That was prior to the opening up of the camps for all the people to leave on a voluntary basis.
That sounds really significant. And you describe all this because you lived it very matter-of-factly, but I imagine at the time, as a teenager, there were a lot of emotions wrapped up in all of this.
Yeah, you know, it's, in hindsight, I can't remember a lot of the things that happened, you know, in the so many years have passed that the memory becomes blurred, but I just can't imagine how I managed to do that when I did.
You have been declared an enemy of your own country, the country you were born in. You're locked behind barbed wire, but as a 17-year-old, you managed to talk them into letting you go and join your father and the rest of your family in Colorado, where you're not in a camp.
But the thing is, see, at the time, sentiment had changed quite a bit, where they figured that we couldn't return back to the western states. Arizona, we could have gone back to, but I think in California, we couldn't go back yet. But then if you decided to go to Colorado, you know, you could do that, or go back east, Midwest, wherever. The situation had loosened to the point where they were wanting people to leave camp. So it made it a little bit easier, but, you know, being 17-year-old, they didn't take me seriously at first.
Well, I'm sure it was really special to have that group of your family together again. But you told me something I want you to share because I think it's pretty significant. From the time the FBI came and took your father away, your family of six, your two parents and you four siblings, the six of you were never, ever together again?
No, we never gathered as a family of six. There was always somebody missing. Primarily, I was taken to the army. My sister was in the WACS. So we were missing. And when I came home on furlough, she was missing. When she came home on furlough, I was missing. In the meantime, my sister got married in Japan to a GI, and they were still in Japan. And he was with the occupation forces there yet. In the meantime, mother had passed away, and she was still back there. She was on the boat coming home when my mother passed, and we had to wait for her to, we had to wait 3 weeks for him before the funeral and all that. And the following year, my dad passed away, so we never got together as six ever again.
How many more of those families uprooted from their homes had a similar story to tell? Robert Uwasaka ended up in Europe toward the end of the war with the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. He's now 97 years old. Again, if you find a Day of Remembrance ceremony in your community this weekend or next weekend, that experience is sure to add to your perspective. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, we'll remember a 102-year-old World War II veteran turned policeman. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. This time of year, I always want to remind you of the Day of Remembrance for Americans of Japanese ancestry and what their families endured 8 decades ago. We did that through the memories of Robert Uwasaka, but the next voice you're going to hear is one that lifted the spirits of many over the last 102 years. This past Thursday in Fresno, California, I had the privilege of attending a memorial service for Bill Biggers, who passed away at the age of 102. He had been the oldest living alumnus of the Fresno Police Department and once survived being knocked off his motorcycle by a deer. He loved to tell that story. As for World War II, Bill had graduated from Orosi High School in 1939. He'd gotten married and even had a son before he ended up in the military.
Most of the class, my classmates, went to Germany. A couple of them were pilots, and we got shot down. And I didn't hear much about the ones that went to the Pacific.
Were there any guys from your class who were killed over there?
Yes. Yes, several of them. One real good friend of mine, he was killed in Italy.
But so you're keeping the ranch going, doing this work, and the newspaper's telling you so-and-so is here, and this is what happened to him.
Oh, yeah.
So what changed for you? How did you eventually end up in the Army?
Of course, I could see the draft coming, you know. Sooner or later, it's coming, you know. And believe it or not, I enlisted in the Navy. And I went up to Camp Beale. That's where they were being inducted at the time. They found a murmur in my heart. They kept me there 3 days, and I was working giving shots to the guys that was going in. And so 3 days later, why, they sent me to San Francisco. And you know the Navy man, what he done to me? He stepped right across that where it said limited duty Navy. He stepped general duty Army. I said, I enlisted in the Navy. He said, we're not taking anybody to the Navy today. So I ended up in the Army. Thank God.
That probably wasn't your attitude at the time, though.
No, it wasn't my attitude that, but one trip over, it changed.
Uh-huh. How did your wife feel about all of that? How'd you handle it with her?
It was okay with her because our son was born and he was just a baby when I shipped out.
So you're shipping out and you're leaving behind a wife and a newborn son?
Yes.
That couldn't have been easy.
It wasn't very easy, no. But she understood. She's a good Christian, and she understood the necessity that we had to win this war.
Was there a question in your mind as to whether you'd make it back to see them again?
I didn't give it any thought, to tell you the truth about it. I just knew I'd make it back. Well, it took us 30 days to get over there because of zigzag.
From San Francisco to Manila?
Yeah. Well, we stopped. There was three ships of us, and we'd had an escort all the way. And we backed up into an island of someplace out there in the Pacific for camouflage. And the next morning, we head out, the three ships, no escort, one right behind the other. Navy guy said we're top speed, and we went right through the war zone and to Manila. I can't understand how we made it, but we did.
And when you say that, you know, before you had escort, now you don't. There's the threat of Japanese submarines all along that way.
Oh, yes. Plus, they still had a few bombers, too, you know.
Sure. The threat aircraft, from the air as well. Uh-huh. And did you get seasick at all?
No. Just the sailors got seasick.
Army's immune to it?
Well, I'll leave out part of that.
Feel free.
Going over, we didn't do, there's four of us didn't want to do calisthenics, you know. We hid out in lifeboats just hanging over the side, and the Navy guys brought our food to us.
How long did you get away with that?
All the way.
30 days?
Well, we only stayed that during the daytime. We went down and sat.
So you never once had to do calisthenics?
But we got to be good card players, I'm telling you.
So you hid in the lifeboats every day, and nobody ever found you?
Nobody ever tried.
I wonder if anybody who's listening is going to try to get away with that at some point. It's like straight out of the movies or something.
Oh, yeah. But anyway, we landed in Manila, in Luzon. There were still firefights. There's still some fighting going on, especially in Wall City. We ran out by rail, and we went 19 kilometers from Manila to a little village called Alabang. It consisted of just a few stands along selling sarsaparilla and Cokes. And then we went further in from Alabang. One morning, First Sergeant come in to our tent and he says, "Biggers, get dressed. We got a mission to go to." This is at 3:30 and he said, "The truck will be leaving at 4. The only thing I asked him, shall I bring the M1 or the carbine? Although I was assigned to a bigger gun, a Browning automatic. But that's not good in the jungle fighting. It's too big, too heavy." So he said, "Bring the M1. So that's what I brought, was the M1. We get on that truck, and 8 hours later, we stopped. We was in pretty heavy jungle type thing area, and the road was good. But I was in the back with another soldier I did not know, American soldier. And I think we had 8 Filipino guerrilla fighters and the first sergeant and the truck driver. And we stopped to rest and have a bite to eat, and all hell broke loose. Because what we were after was the main body of the Japanese had surrendered, but we had these ones that skipped out, got away, and they were causing a lot of trouble, and we were up there to find them.
So these are some Japanese who didn't want to surrender, who then went further back, and you had to kind of round them up, or that was the hope anyway.
That was the hope, yeah, but they found us before we found them.
So you're thinking you're taking a lunch break, and when did you know that's not what was happening?
Very shortly. We didn't get to eat anything.
Because they started firing on you?
Firing started coming, but it was very fortunate because we were somewhat protected unless they came over the hill. It was just a small risings, but our truck never got hit. This American soldier that was with me, we crawled about, I'd say close to 100 feet down through the jungle. There was a trail there, but we didn't want to get on the trail because we could be seen. So we crawled down to the waterfront. We had noticed this every once in a while you could see this water. It was not running, it was just standing water. And the Japanese were on the other side of that.
So you crawled down there on your bellies?
On our bellies.
The enemy is still firing in your direction?
Oh, yeah. Now we could be seen. Now he and I could. I don't know what happened to the other people at that time because they never came down.
So they might have stayed with the truck.
Evidently, I don't think the Filipinos did, because when we got back the truck after a couple hours, there were no Filipinos around.
But for a couple hours, you're in a situation you've never been in before.
Absolutely. It's not like when you're in basic training, when you crawl underneath that wiring, you know, and they're firing above you, telling you that it's live ammunition, but it's probably blanks. But that was live, and we knew it.
How close was it coming to you?
Not really that close, because it was heavy jungle where we had crawled down, and we separated probably 20 feet apart, because if they spotted one, they might not sight the other one, you know. And we were pretty well hid, and we had plenty of ammo.
But there's only two of you.
Only two of us.
And you don't know how many of the Japanese there are.
Have no idea, because across this water, it'd be hard for me to estimate how across it was, that water. And it wasn't running, it's just standing water, muddy. They were in we thought it was an island out in this water. That's what it looked like to us. And that was grown up with banana trees. And they were inside that. You couldn't see anybody.
So what were those 2 hours like? What kind of things were you doing, and what were you dealing with?
Well, it was just a gunfight. That's all you can say about it. And they never did get close to us, because we were pretty well hid. I don't know. So finally, we figured either they escaped, or we, no telling what happened. We didn't know what happened, because we wouldn't dare get out into that water, because first place we didn't know how deep it was, and if it was not very deep, we'd be standing objects, you know.
With no cover.
With no cover, and we didn't want to duck down in that muddy water, because we didn't know what else was in that muddy water either.
So after a couple hours, you don't know if you've hit any of them. You don't know if they've gotten away.
Oh, yeah, we were pretty sure we hit them.
Well, this is why I'm asking the questions.
Yeah, we were pretty sure we hit him. We saw some kind of an automatic weapon coming out. We could see that firing. We couldn't see the ones it was using with rifles or whatever, but we saw that automatic weapon. I don't even know what it was. It's just like a machine gun, but it was automatic, you know. And we both fired at that, and it dumped out into the water. So we knew that one was gone. But finally, the gunfire stopped. Then we found out that was not an island. It was just a outcropping, I guess you'd call it, into this water.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't know how many got away.
Thinking it's an island and they'd have to go through the water, but afterwards you found out they could have backed out where you couldn't see.
Yeah, we couldn't see where they went back to land. It was a peninsula, in other words.
Mm-hmm. So the gunfire stops. I imagine that's kind of a nervous deal to figure out when it's safe to move.
Yeah. We wait. We give it plenty of time. We'd fire a couple of rounds in just to make sure. We didn't get any return fire, so we assumed it. So we started back. On the way back, we come across two recently killed Japanese soldiers. How they were killed, I don't know. But it was very recent. And it didn't seem like they might have came from, I don't know how they got across that water, because we didn't see any way to get across on land the water. They were dry. Their clothes were dry. Anyway, we left them. You know, we went on to our thing. And when we got back to our truck, there were no Filipinos. And the first sergeant was a basket case. The truck driver had tried to keep him safe. They got in behind the wheels of the truck, just in case. And that's where we found the truck driver and the first sergeant. But the first sergeant was a basket case, really. He had gone berserk, but we later found out that was his first trip overseas. He had always been in a unit in the States.
So the two of them had stayed with the truck the whole time?
They stayed in the truck the whole time, yeah. And we tried to find the Filipinos, but we never found them. I don't know where they went. But anyway, we found a place we could turn that truck around and headed back to base. But that lasted about 22 hours altogether, the time we got back to the base.
Sounds like that might have been one of the longest days of your young life.
Well, you know, I was raised in church. I was not a guy that went out drinking and all that jazz all my life. I had been raised in church, and you won't believe this, but the first thing I thought of when the gunfire started was the 23rd Psalms. Mm-hmm. Hey, we'll walk through the valley of death. I fear, have no fear. And I had no fear.
Wow. There's something that you felt in that
moment. I felt I was safe. I really did.
Another experience Bill Biggers had during his 11 months of occupation duty in post-war Japan also struck him as divinely ordained.
As we walk into this little town, the main seemed like the main part of town, some of the business part hadn't been hit that hard, but the town had burnt because they knocked out the water, and it's an oceanfront town, had been hit that part, but there's only one building standing in a big Vance area there, one building, a two-story building. And you won't believe this. Gospel music. Although they were singing in Japanese, we knew the songs. So we joined them.
Wow.
Yeah, we went in and we were taking off our boots and we saw a little girl peek out from upstairs because they were upstairs. And then she went back in. And then we found out later that she went back in and the pastor of the church asked her, what's going on? She says, American soldiers. What are they doing? They're taking their boots off. He says, that sounds good because we know they're friendly now because they're following our customs.
Mm-hmm.
So we joined them and we sang with them.
Some hymns that you had sung in church
growing up.
Oh,
yeah, that we knew that. And you, the funny part about this, four of us, I was raised in the Assembly of God. One guy was a Baptist. One guy was a Church of Christ. And the fourth guy was a Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
So what a team.
Got all your bases covered.
Got all our bases covered. So we joined them after the service, the pastor. Well, just after that, they followed our customs like we do. They all joined hands so the circle won't be unbroken and had prayer. And so we took this little Japanese girl, looked like she's probably 18, 19 years old, and I took her hand and my soldiers, and we all joined hands. And then after the pastor came back, and of course we had the books, you know, from Japanese to American, American to Japanese. And he came back and tried to talk to us a little bit. And the little girl that I sat next to, she invited us to their home.
Mm.
So we went to their home. They wanted to give us something to eat. They had nothing to speak of.
Mm.
They had what on the ranch we called horse beans. I don't remember the real name of them, but it's a big bean like a lima, only a little larger.
Mm-hmm.
And they baked those. They open up and you eat the kernel inside. That gave us an idea. We could buy food at the PX, very reasonable. I can remember the one thing I can very remember was Sacramento tomato juice. A big old can, probably a quart or maybe bigger, 15 cents.
Mm-hmm.
So we took a lot of food to them.
Mm.
A lot of food, because they were starving at our camp. We'd go out after we ate, you know, and the Japanese men, 50, 60 years old, digging the garbage for food. Well, the four of us didn't do that. If it's something we didn't particularly want or didn't, like a slice of bread, we didn't throw it in the garbage. So they brought, they realized the four of us was going to throw it in the garbage, so they'd bring buckets so they could put the good food in.
Mm.
So we took a lot of food to those to that family, and I told this girl very plainly now, we brought you this food, and don't you sell it. If we bring you more than you want, you want to give it to your friends, that's all right, but don't you sell it. We gave it to you because you were hungry.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I know, they never sold that. So we stayed there, visited with that Japanese family and other Japanese family, not just them,
mm-hmm.
all the time. We were the 11 months I was in that service. And, of course, two of the guys of the four of us, two of them were single and two of us were married. And we were truthful with it because we told them we were married and there was, you know, nothing going on between us and the family. And I can remember when I got my shipping orders. Well, they thought I overstepped that. We were moving from Okayama down to Nagasaki. They thought we were going home. And these two girls, the older one and the younger one, come. And they found us as we were getting on the train. And they said to me, Bill-san, Maureen and Ronnie say, Bill, come home. We say, Bill, stay. So anyway, no, we went down then to Nagasaki, and I left and come home from Nagasaki. I saw the devastation there. I didn't see much in Nagasaki, but they stopped the train there. We wasn't allowed to get off, but you sure see the devastation. We stopped at the railroad station, and just nothing but a few walls left standing.
That experience where you and your friend, well, three of your friends, you stumble into this church, and they're singing the hymns, and their words are Japanese, but you know the tune, and you're singing along. Is there something that moment, that experience taught you, or when you think back on it now, it makes you realize?
Well, the thing that I realized about it, it wasn't the Japanese people. It was the government that was rotten. We never had 1 minute's problem with the Japanese people. Not one problem at all. Now, this family, their father had been killed in Manchuria when that war was going on. It seemed to me that the civilians were nice people.
Bill Biggers, after 102 years on Earth, now reunited above with his wife Maureen and his son Ron. And I imagine it might not look all too different from that picture he painted in post-war Japan. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, World War II memories from one of America's newly minted centenarians. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level. When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-530-530.
38-33-28. Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We have touched today on one chapter of history we should always remember, honored the memory of a 102-year-old that we'll never forget, and now I want to give you a little taste of a spirited World War II veteran who joined the ranks of the centenarians. Joe Ray has just turned 100. He was only 20 when he arrived in France as a gunner on a 7-man half-track crew with the 473rd Anti-Aircraft Artillery Battalion.
One to operate the 37mm, two to operate the 50 calibers, vertical tracker and horizontal tracker, and I was a gunner. When I saw that we were probably getting a hit, why then I let loose with the 37mm. The 50 calibers are being fired by the cannoneers. They're feeding the 50 calibers machine gun. The other one is making sure feeding the 37mm. It's automatic. You don't have to load. You just got a cartridge of 10. And we just go right down as you're firing automatic with a 37 millimeter gun. There was the sergeant in the driving compartment of the half track, and there's the driver, and there's five of us inside of the half track to operate them, the machine guns and the 37 millimeter gun.
You mentioned Omaha Beach, so this is less than a week after the initial landing. You're D-Day plus six. Early June 1944. Can you help us understand what you saw when you came ashore? What that whole scene looked like, sounded like, smelled like?
Oh, yeah. You know, the Corps has to pick up all the dead bodies, and according to their tags, they identified. We saw bodies still floating. It was something that you just can't bring it into mind. It's you can't say it's horrible. It's worse than that. The boys that survived that invasion, I don't think they'll ever be the same again. Their eyes, what they saw, what they felt, it's, you can't explain what your eyes saw. It's to hell and back. That's what it is. It's the only way you can describe it, you know, to hell and back. I don't know if I can answer anymore.
Well, so you're seeing all this evidence of what's happened in the preceding days, and none of that's very encouraging. But then you're going to be fired upon as well. What was the first instance of that you experienced? What was the first hazard or danger to yourself that you realized?
Shoot them before they shoot me. Survive. You keep your wits and operate your guns properly, and don't be afraid. If you're afraid, don't show it. Just hide it and do your job, or else you're not going to be around. They're going to kill your position. So you don't even think about that. You're operating that gun and boom, 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 bang. And so not only my half track, but the other half tracks get them before they get me. That was a motto we had to do. We didn't even, when you're operating that gun, you don't think about dying. You only think about making accurate to make sure you knock down the planes. That was our motto.
Well, that's what I was going to get to. So you're the 473rd Anti-Aircraft Artillery Battalion. So your job is to shoot down planes. What was the first opportunity you had to do that? What was the first time you encountered enemy planes?
Well, we encountered them when our supplies were coming on board. We were positioned inland already. We had columns of material providing the war, guns, tanks, quartermaster. You know, they carry the food and all of that. And we'd be right there on besides the side of the road, all strung out. The whole battalion strung out like that, give them air cover. Sometimes we got them, and sometimes some of them was bound to sneak in. And the bay battery would get the most of it because they were way up ahead. But we made sure we stay alive by being accurate. If the planes were too far, we would shoot a barrage. And they never make it. The intense of that barrage was like 4th of July. They knew they couldn't get to that barrage, so they come down low. Right beside your gun position, you couldn't fire. You know, and then way over there, they come up.
And so these would be Messerschmitt 109s or the FW-190s who are diving and strafing you guys?
Messerschmitts and The Stuka and the Wolf, they had a bomber, and then they didn't even try to bomb us. They just go right down, and you couldn't shoot at them. Our barrage was so intense. I mean, to tell you, they get hit before they even get to the target. We instead of using my scope for the distance, just fire out there, try and get as close as you can to him because he's about 2 miles out and he's out of range on your mill screen. So you just fire above him and ahead of him. He's so far out, but still you can still get a hit. You get a still barrage, you're still effective.
So what you guys were doing, because of the strength of how many anti-aircraft guns you had, you were creating a wall of flak that they would have to fly through?
That's it, a wall of fire. And it was difficult for them to get through it. And they were getting hit. Well, like I said, they just died out, no. And you couldn't fire at them. They'd go by and they would wave, especially the ones on the bombers. They turn around there, you could see their face, and they wave like this, you know, give out the old salute, and we go like this.
You give them the one-finger salute?
One-finger story. Oh, we give him five.
Well, you can laugh about it now, but at the time, as a teenager, halfway around the world with bullets flying.
We were serious. I mean, to tell you, we were serious because we knew what their mission was, to try and hit the column, you know, that was going up to the front supplies, supplying some of the troops that were up there on front. You know, tanks were going up there to the front. Germans were retreating. They had some standoff, you know, but where it cost us a little lives, but we kept on going, and we all thought the same thing. Let's get this over with so we can go home.
Well, and you said earlier that there were a few moments where you weren't sure you were going to come home, where your brown Mexican skin turned white because you were so afraid. Now, is that hyperbole, or you think you really turned white?
Well, there was one airplane we hit, and I'm telling you, that plane didn't change direction. He came straight at our half track. And I say, hey, that guy is hit. Why is he coming straight? And then the first thought we said, he's committing suicide. Cover. And all we did was just cover like that because we didn't have time to jump into the slit ranges. So we just cover like this, and whoosh, he went right by. He missed us by 5 feet. 5 feet, and we could smell the, you know, the air as it went by. He still had his bomb in there. He went by us and hit a building about 40 yards away. We could feel the concussion of the bomb, made a big hole over there, and then everybody on the battery was phoning on D battery, on our section, and some of the other sections, everybody was phoning to see if we were all right. I actually thought we got hit. You know, it came so close. And another time, still in supply lines, and we stopped for about, 5 minutes. Sometimes they stop. You gotta follow the lead jeep. With the colonel or the major, then I felt the pain when... Oh, we stopped and we unlock our cannon. You lock it, keep it from going like this, you know, because there's so much play on the turret. Mm-hmm. So you lock it. First thing we did was unlock the gun. We turn it around so we had maybe a feel of fire there in case we were told to fire at will. All of a sudden, there was a ping! Cling, 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 and the doggone bullet came around inside of the half track, you know. Well, a sniper, the reason that bullet was going that way, because it hit the barrel of the gun on the very edge of the barrel, and I was right behind it. He missed me because he hit the barrel of the gun with maybe that much.
So you were less than an inch away from getting hit by that sniper's bullet.
And then I heard an infantryman say, we'll get him. You know, the infantry coming up. It was already dusk. And he said, we'll get him. I heard him say that.
So you're sitting in the half track behind the barrel of that gun. They shoot right at the barrel. It glances off the side and ricochets all throughout your half track, but never hits you.
I never did find that. I wanted to find that ricocheting bullet and never did find it. You know, I would have taken it as a memoir, you know. Well, my heart went boom, 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 man, you know. And, he missed me. It was a good thing. He would have hit me right here.
Right in the heart?
Yes, right above the heart. It would have hit me. I still think the barrel of that gun was in the way that we ricocheted off.
So you land in Normandy. In June of 44, you go through the Normandy campaign. Where did you go from there?
We went to Belgium. We got to Belgium. We headed toward the front. Pat was up with the troops, you know, sometimes. You'll get right in there. We went up. It was a cold. You couldn't. Zero. Infantry was going out. Oh, you could see it strung out one side to the other. Bazooka guys, you know, but the equipment, well, they couldn't travel through the snow. It was about, must have been about 8 feet high. So they walked. They could walk through the snow. And one of them said, see those two guys over there? See, they're frozen. Two Germans were frozen. He says, they were covered with a blanket. We took the blanket off, and there it is. Two Germans frozen to death. We ask each other, what are we doing here with all those trees? And what are we going to use us as artillery? Can't even use us as artillery. We're not up in the front. We're way behind, and the trees are like Yosemite, you know. I mean, there was no place for us. Sure enough, about half or an hour later, there comes a jeep going right through beside the half tracks. And he stops at the leading column, you know, and turned us around, got out of there. They had no use for us. Airplanes, the weather, the way it was, neither side could fly because, you know, they wouldn't know where the bombs were going to land. We didn't have the equipment then that we have now. You know, all we had is radios. And
So you're talking about the Battle of the Bulge. The weather was so bad, the visibility was so low that flying wasn't feasible until right around Christmas when that finally broke. At that time, did they move you guys back into position or no?
Yes, we went to Holland. We was lining our battery up, covering Patton's tanks going into Germany from Holland. Well, the Holland people were really grateful for the liberation. Some of us said, if the Germans break through here, they'll send you back to the sea, just like that Dunkirk from the British. And we were afraid of that. And if they come back and they know that we were friendly with the troops, he says, we don't know what's going to happen to us. So it didn't happen. They were very grateful. It was a nice, beautiful place, Holland. Better than, I think it was better than even Paris. We love that place. The people, well, are speaking English. A lot of them, most of them spoke English. Teachers were out there, professors and everything. And up ahead, you could hear the doggone firing, you know, of the infantry. And they didn't care. We were being liberated. They came out there, the bullets were bouncing everywhere, and they didn't care. Welcome the Americans, you know. So we covered Patton. It wasn't long. A week, then we went into Germany. We were about 15 miles on the superhighway. Autobahn, they called it. They stopped us. Germans had given up. British from the left over there. The Russians from over there. And a stream of people coming back from Germany to the American side. They didn't want nothing to do with the Russians. They didn't know what to expect from the Russians because of the war that Germany had caused Russia at that time. So maybe they were out for revenge and they didn't want nothing to do with them. So there's a stream of refugees coming to the American sectors. Well, war was over. They brought us home. We wanted to see Berlin, actually. We waited. We were then sent back to England on barges. We waited in England for about 3 months because we didn't have enough points. The infantry had most of the points. You know, the GIs had been on foot and tanks. And the front fighting, they earn more points, so they get to go home first. And we were just on the aircraft, so we waited about 3 months.
Do you remember the look on your mother's face when you walked through the door?
Oh, let me tell you, I went to the address they gave me, and that was my aunt's house. So I knocked on the door. It was late at night. My uncle and my aunt come out. I didn't know them. So I embraced my aunt thinking it was my mother. Because, you know, she looked like so much like her mother. I'm home, Mom. Well, son, I'm not your mom, but thanks for the hug. You know, she's that type of woman, you know. Uh-huh. I'll take it to her, Mom. You can hug her all you want. She said. So from there, we got home and got a big party for my homecoming. Everybody was glad that I made it home.
And the party this past week was because we're all glad he made it to the century mark. If you head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you can link to Joe's complete original interview from 5 years ago and find more with the other veterans whose stories touched our hearts today. Thank you so much for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.